Hello, it's George Anderson here, and I am joined today by a nutritional and lifestyle evolutionary anthropologist and author of Deadly Harvest, Jeff Bond. So, hey Jeff, how are you doing?
Hello there, George.
Did I get that right?
You did pretty well there. It's a bit of a mouth.
Basically, evolutionary and anthropologist. We're looking at how we used to live, and kind of going way back to the Paleolithic era, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. That kind of sums it up, I guess, doesn't it? What your area of
expertise is. Let me give you a little bit of background. When I was a kid and we went to the zoo, you would see signs in front of the cages, and they said, please don't feed the animals. And you kind of know that if you feed a gorilla on popcorn, it gets sick and dies. And the zookeeper knows there's a particular feeding pattern for each of the species. And even his children probably know that if you put a cat, a canary and bird seed in a cage, the cat will eat the canary and not the bird seed. And yet we used to have the idea that human beings could eat anything. And I was brought up as a vegetarian, which was regarded as a bit of a cranky thing to be back in those days. But my parents and grandparents were part of this kind of movement that thought that this was a clean way of living. But they didn't have a particularly good rationale for it. And I was looking for a rationale. But the reality is that nobody really had any idea what the right feeding pattern for the human species was. Until much more recently, and confirmation came through just in the 1980s by the study of genetics, when we understood that everybody on this planet is descended from a small group of people who lived just 2,000 generations ago, as you say, in the savannas of East Africa, just 60,000 years ago, and that we, most importantly, we still have the same digestive systems, the same biochemistry, the same mentalities as for life back then. And the way that the human feeding pattern is the one that those people were adapted to back then. Now, since, as you say, this was the Paleolithic era, this has subsequently become called the Paleo lifestyle, the Paleo diet, which is a pretty good shorthand. I originally called this the Savannah model, I called it natural eating, but bit by bit this has all become the word paleo has come to take over. And of course, all this is very new. But the bottom line is, hey, yes, the paleo diet, the paleo lifestyle is the right pattern for human beings and none other. And it is the Bible. It is the actual answer as to how humans should be feeding themselves.
Well, that's great. I mean, actually, that answers one of my first questions, which is why should I care? Why should anybody who watches this, why should anybody care what we did 60,000 years ago? And so really what you're saying is that this is our genetic blueprint, that this is how we should be eating and living to many, and we're going to cover that, touch on that as well today in this short video, about how we should be living our lives, both in terms of society and some of the other aspects. And we've gone through all these generations and we've kind of come away from this natural point, and now we're looking at a way of getting back and getting closer to it. And the answer, as you said, lies in our genetic blueprint.
Well, this is it, and if you like, the mismatch between the way we live today and the way nature intended, so to speak, is now a huge problem for our health in particular, for our lifespans, and for our mental health. And so, yes, it's a vast topic, but it is a wonderfully liberating experience that once you understand this, and once you understand where we need to be going, then you can actually take control of this in your own life and steer yourself into the way that your body recognizes and the way your brain recognizes. And that way you live a much better life.
Okay, well, one of the things I really want to get out today is a handful of some specific things that people can do to actually start making some changes to going back towards this old model. I mean, in the context of modern life as well, because we can't just start wearing loincloths and start running around hunting saber-toothed tigers. So we're going to look at it in the context of modern life. But before that, I just want to talk to you briefly about what a paleo lifestyle looks like. I mean, what is it? Because I think that the struggle I have with it, and the struggle a lot of people have with this notion, is that modern life is so vastly different. We have so many shortcuts, things to do, things we don't have to do anymore, that don't require, things that used to require effort now don't require any effort. And we have no we've come from a however many generations of scarcity, and now we have abundance. So what does a modern paleo lifestyle look like? What is it, in essence?
Well, I think this is a very big subject. Now, of course, we're looking at diet, yes, what are you eating and drinking? We're looking at other aspects of lifestyle, like how do you sleep? After all, these people lived an outdoor life, you know, is our sunshine's an important aspect. And of course, physical activity. There's a Paleolithic pattern of physical activity that is right for us, Paleolithic pattern of sunshine, sleeping patterns, and of course, of diet. And I think you just have to, plus all sorts of other lifestyle aspects. And I think you just have to break this down and just take them one by one. I often do talk about the outdoor life. After all, we're all designed to live outdoors and be in the sunshine. We now know that absence of sunshine is a tremendous problem, a tremendous factor in a lot of health problems today. We all know about the absence of physical activity, which our body expects to be there, and if it isn't there, things go wrong, and ditto with all the other things. But if we just look at what people were eating, this is where I sometimes say to people, hey, you just have to sometimes confront your preconceived ideas. I said I was brought up as a vegetarian, and bit by bit, as the evidence thumped into place, I had to grudgingly accept that human beings weren't designed to be vegetarians.
Okay.
But in fact, foragers all through the whole eons of human prehistory, human beings were eating animals of various kinds, animal matter of various kinds. I use a very vague term. And some 25% by weight of what they were eating would have been animal matter. And the other 75% of it would be plant food of a particular plant kind. And I suppose that's the very first lesson that we need to be saying, is that yes, it's animal matter of a particular kind is absolutely right and essential. And so is large volumes of plant food of a particular kind absolutely right and essential. Now, once we start getting down into the little bit of the detail, the plant food, the big thing, and I think this is the very first lesson that people can take away with them, is that the plant food was what we call low glycemic. Yes, human beings are designed for a low glycemic diet, one which doesn't give you sharp blood sugar spikes and consequent sharp insulin spikes. And that means a diet which doesn't have starches and which doesn't have sugars in it. Broadly speaking, you know, that's the very first thing. And that means, of course, that has, it's easily said, but that has huge consequences, because as soon as you start saying that, then you say, well, that's the grains and all the things that you make from grains, all the cereals, the rice, the wheat, the barley, and all the rest of it are actually not human food. And I sometimes laughingly call them birdseed. That's why we would be eating canaries rather than bird seeds, just like the cat. That means that basically these items are not human food and we should not be eating them, and in all their various guises, the pastas, the breakfast cereals, and so forth. And other starch sources of starches, classically potato, that too is problematic. It's not proper human food. And in fact, right up until Shakespeare's time, it was regarded as pig food. Used for fattening pigs, of all things. Well, yes, it fattens human beings too, and it makes them sick. So that's the first lesson, is that the low glycemic diet is right for human beings, and that grains and potatoes and other starchy vegetables are not right for human beings.
Let's talk about lifestyle briefly as well, Jeff, because I know that you're a big advocate of the notion that we're designed genetically, we're designed, and we would have spent long times in clans, in groups, mm-hmm. with families, and those connections would have been there. What else can you tell us about lifestyle and some of the changes that perhaps have happened, and how we can maybe start moving back towards what is better for our health and our psyche, mental health, and physical health?
Well, now this is it's a very interesting subject, and also quite a sensitive subject. When you imagine that people back then were living in forager bands of about 40 to 50 people, 10 or 12 families, and they would have a territory which was theirs, and they would defend that territory against neighbouring bands, and sometimes they would try and invade somebody else's territory if there was something interesting on the other side. But this forager band is the sort of natural size, if you like, of a human group. They would, and this leads to the notion of in-group and out-group. They were the in-group. Your forager band was the in-group. You were loyal to them. You didn't do them down. You didn't cheat on them. You didn't lie to them. But you could do what you liked to somebody from one of the other groups. And of course, in a kind of bigger way, you can see that this is how the Ten Commandments came out, which was designed basically for the Jewish tribe. And they thought it was perfect. Amongst the first commandments was "Thou shalt not kill." But as soon as Moses came down from the mount with "Thou shalt not kill" on one of the tablets, God gave the orders to go out nevertheless and kill the Amalekites and carry off the children and rape the wives and all this. So this was still part of the notion that you have your clan, which would only be 40 to 50 people, you were loyal to them. And the big challenge today, and I think it's remarkable, is that we manage to socialize children, and it has to be a process of socialization where they come to recognize that that almost anybody can be considered part of the in-group. And that you can't just do down or lie to anybody else who is not part of your clan. On the other hand, what we do have is atomization of the clan. We now we're atomized down to just a family. What was the nuclear family, the husband, wife, and two children, and now even that's split up down to often a single mum with one child. And that is, if you like, in purely evolutionary terms, something to which human beings are not naturally adapted. Mm. And of course, what happens is then that you find that governments have to take over that process of providing what a clan would have provided, the support systems and all the rest. So this is a very big question, politically sensitive, of course, but one which, nevertheless, when we get back to it, when we talk about people who are better in their skins, they're better adjusted, part of it is because they feel part of a group which is self-supporting. It might be family, it is, but otherwise it can be other kinds of groups. It can be sort of classically it's churches, it's various kinds of religious groupings, it can be clubs, societies, it can be all kinds of groups, which nevertheless, where they feel part of. In other words, they're not totally alone. So yes, this is an aspect which is important to as a part of human existence, that you feel part of a group where you can trust the people around you, that you don't have to watch your back for those people around you. Trusting other people. Yeah.
That is something that is, you know, we're all capable of achieving. We're all capable of making, mm. you know, taking action to move back that way. Do you think that we all, whether we're conscious of it or not, we have our set point here, and we're over here at the moment, and we've always got, you know, the more we try and stay over here, the more we're drawn over back to this set point, which is this evolutionary idea of this unit, this band, this small, close-knit group that we can trust, and we're over here and trying to move back, and that draw is quite stressful in some way.
We're having to make instead of being able to operate in accordance with just what comes naturally without thinking, reflexes, we're having to constantly monitor ourselves and discipline ourselves to behave in socially acceptable ways. But the big challenge is that we're now in a world where we can't go back. we're not forager bands. With 200 square miles per forager band to live in, with a population density of one per square mile. We're now hundreds of millions in the country, and we've got to industrialise every single process of keeping ourselves alive. It's clearly food production and all the rest of it that goes with it. So we're now in this machine, whether we like it or not. We've got a tiger by the tail. What we can do is try and get control of it for ourselves, because the machine itself it grinds on, you know, and it chews us up, spits us out at the other end if we're not careful. But what we can do is have to take control of it, as much of it as we can for ourselves, by a little bit of life that we can. And, you know, this is you can do this in all various kinds of ways, but it's tough. I fully agree. But once you understand that what's going on, then you can look at your own particular lifestyle and think about ways in which you can try and adjust you and make decisions which make these things easier for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's the key point, Jeff, for me anyway. It's looking at thinking and being aware of it and understanding what, you know, we all may feel that draw back towards something, but not necessarily knowing why. So kind of seeing it as part of our makeup, this is what we're, how we're designed to be, how we're designed to live, explains it to a large extent. And that makes it perhaps easier to make those tough choices and to make those changes to start rebuilding the lifestyle that we perhaps, you know, we should have.
One of the examples I give is the workplace. I mean, working for foragers was just going out and foraging. And they did it for 3 or 4 hours a day, and then they were done. But the important point was that, first of all, it was something, it was what their life was. That was their raison d'etre. You know, that was fulfilling. So their work was fulfilling. Secondly, they only did it 3 or 4 hours a day. They were doing it 7 days a week, probably, but they were only working 20 hours a week. Thirdly, there wasn't anybody in charge of their livelihood. They wanted to feed their family. They just got up, walked off into the bush, started collecting berries, trapping birds or whatever, and they did it. And if somebody, for some reason, fell on hard times, well, the other members of the band would help them out, get them over that temporary problem, because it was always reciprocated. There was a strong sense of reciprocity in the forager band, where people would help each other out if you know, somebody went for some reason hunting and it just didn't work out for 3 or 4 days in a row. There was that sense of reciprocity. But in particular, there wasn't this particular machine that we're living in, which is really a product of the industrial age. We forget that this has only been around for 100 years. We actually have employers and employees, and that you work for a certain set period of your lifespan until you're 60, 65, whatever it is. They work you until they squeezed all the pips dry, and then they chuck you out and they say, right, now go and enjoy yourself, go and retire, which is, again, totally unnatural way of being. The ideal is that you have a process, if you like, of livelihood, which is fulfilling, which is not too challenging, and which you continue until you come to the end of your life, because then you still retain your dignity, you retain your sense of self-worth, you're still contributing. This is a vital part of mental health as well.
So, well, actually, Jeff, we've got quite a few things there, and some specific things that we can do. And, I mean, some of them, like changing, you know, we're not going to turn into foragers and just go and, find our food for 3 or 4 hours a day. Not nicer that would be, but in a modern context, that's not practical, as you well know. But I couldn't do it myself. But we have considered, well, you live in Cyprus, that's not fair. That's a bit easy.
Well, I mean, this is a lifestyle choice, absolutely. Yeah. You know, a lifestyle choice is to work for myself, not have an employer, and to live in a place which has got sunshine and palm trees. It means sacrifices. It means I can't be part of the buzz of a big city, but I go back to a big city to get my fix. And in a way, going to big cities, it is a bit like being on drugs. You're getting an unnatural fix of stimulation, which the average forager would only get once a year, or quite a couple of times a year, when they would have what they call a jamboree, or when they'd have a big get together with the other tribes. The meeting of the tribes, and they would have perhaps for 1 year, a year or so, once a year, they would have this big get together and have their fix. But in a way, this is part of a lifestyle choice. But of course, it has its drawbacks, because it means that you're separated to some extent from family and from other people. You have to make other kinds of social connections. These things aren't easy. This is not easy in today's world. But yes, in a sense, this is one of the choices that I've made consciously.
Yeah.
That living in England, I am obviously a Londoner indeed, that the gloomy, long gloomy weather in the winter time is not for me. It's not for any human being. You know, I sometimes say to people, yeah, you know, really, people shouldn't be living north of a latitude 35 degrees north or south, you know.
But there are, as we've already mentioned, several nutritional things, some diet choices we are capable of making. Yes. Hard though they may seem at first, but certainly removing grains from your diet is a big change. And whenever I coach people nutritionally, it is the thing that they struggle the most with. Especially as I work with a lot of runners, and runners are just so used to having bowls of pasta and bread to fuel their activity, and feeling like they're very low in energy if they don't have some kind of starchy carbohydrates to fuel the intense and prolonged activity that they do. But it is possible to do that, because vegetables, it's often disregarded that they're a fantastic source of carbohydrate, and you know it's not going to give you those same spikes to blood sugar levels as you would do if you're having that bowl of pasta or a plate of table sugar. So that's certainly for me what people can take away from this. This is one of the first things that we can do diet-wise to start returning back to our natural way. And as you said, just increasing the amount of plant food that we consume. So we've always been told that vegetables are good for us. Now yes. Here we have, this is even more evidence.
Yes.
Even more evidence that is the case. So that's a good thing as well. And you know, I'm always, again, trying to encourage people to eat more veggies at every eating point in the day, not just having a couple of portions of meat and two veg in the evening, but to have them all the way through the day and sneaking them in there as much as possible as well. You mentioned there about the lifestyle choices as well, being a part of a community, being a part of a group, your family, work colleagues as well. It's something we're designed to do. We're designed to socialise, and that's a very important thing for our health, mental health as well as physical health. I'd go as far as to say you feel more motivated to engage in physical activity when you're happy. And it swings both ways, because then when you're exercising, you feel happier and more likely to want to go out there and engage socially. So let's have a knock on effect.
Well, absolutely. The physical activity is part of modulating all kinds of hormonal functions, including ones to do with mood. And just to come back on the idea of carbohydrate loading and so on, in a sense, yes, you can use starches, which is what we're talking about really, isn't it? Starches and perhaps sugars as a kind of a, I suppose, a performance-enhancing drug, which is not the way it would normally have been back in forager times. On the whole, foragers didn't do endurance stuff much, although Lawrence van der Post, back in the 1950s, related a story of how he was with a little band of forager sand bushmen trying to follow them in a Land Rover across the desert. Of course, it was bumping around and only doing about 7 or 8 miles an hour. But foraging, as they were jogging along for 24 hours to track down a wounded antelope that they'd shot with a poisoned arrow, but the thing just was kept going until they finally ran it down. And so it did happen, and it would happen from time to time, that they would do this. But of course, they weren't stuffing themselves with carbohydrates first or anything like that. They yeah. just got up and started running because that was the way it was. And of course, there is a movement now amongst of paleo athletes who are now trying to and are following the paleo system of eating and doing perfectly all right on it. And I certainly got one or two followers myself who are Ironman athletes who are perfectly happy with the results they're getting following the paleo system, paleo diet, if you like. They certainly have to load up a lot more on the fatty fish, I think, to get their calories. But yeah. And as I said to them, in the end, being an Ironman isn't really what the human frame is designed for. So, by all means, twist, if you like, the paleo diet to suit what you have to do. But understand that this isn't perhaps what nature intended your body to be doing.
I love your description, actually, in some of the talks that I've seen you give, of what would happen if we're designed actually to. We're going to be, if we're back in the paleolithic day, we'd probably be a bit peckish most of the time.
Yes.
And your explanation as to why that is, if you feel a bit hungry, you can't just go to the fridge and get some coconut out. You've got to get up, walk a mile, climb a tree, knock a nut down, and then bring it back in. It's a bit more of a hassle. And, so that's why we get so freaked out by getting hungry. Because yeah. food is so readily available. We just have to reach out our hand and grab the nearest, biscuit or energy bar or fix and then we're done.
Well, this is true, and it's bizarre because I'm of sort of the generation where first 15 years of my life, we were on rations. So you were hungry, whether you liked it or not. They didn't have the ration coupon to get any more. Where your mother had a lock on the larder door, and when she was preparing the meal, well, she'd get the food out and get whatever your ration was ready, and then put the lock back on. And in a sense, that's how it was for foragers. You know, there was this natural barrier to just feeding yourself whenever you felt like it. But the other side of it, which is the important side of it, is that feeling hungry from time to time, and as I say, we're not talking about fasting or starving, we're just talking about feeling hungry until the next meal, is part of balancing up the way the hormones work in the body, in particular the insulin, glucagon axis and various other ones too, which are all part of the healthy, keeping a healthy body and a healthy mind, sharpening mentality, cognitive reasoning and so on.
Yeah, and you know, our digestive systems equally, I imagine, aren't designed to be functioning 24 hours a day or even 18 hours a day. You know, they need to have that break, they need to have that rest where they're, you know, your tummy might be growling a little bit, but that's not necessarily a sign that your metabolism is all of a sudden plummeting, you're going to go into starvation mode. Because that doesn't happen as quickly as just a few hours, does it? It takes a little bit longer for that to kick in.
No. No, it doesn't. I mean, the reality is that foragers were eating, you know, weren't often actually starving. You know, they got hungry just because there was that tension between the trouble of getting the food and feeling hungry. And so you got that point where the tension was too much and they had to go off and do something. So there was never that. So they were never actually going to what the extremes some people do, which is to skip a meal or starve themselves for a day, or do what the Muslims do during Ramadan, and I've done it with them when I've lived in Arabic countries, where you just don't eat between or drink between sunrise and sunset.
Yeah.
And it can be really tough because when I was doing it, whenever it was 25 years ago now, 30 years ago, Ramadan was right in the height of summer when sun rose at 4 in the morning and then set again at 8 o'clock at night. So you only had 8 hours, if you like, of darkness during which you could eat, and then you had 16 hours when you jolly well couldn't do anything. Now that again is, you know, they regarded this as a cleansing operation, and it's good to remind themselves of what it's like for poor people and who haven't got enough to eat and so forth. But on the other hand, I still regard that as being an unnatural level of fasting. I'm not saying to people you should do things like that, particularly they're not drinking. It's pretty tough. I was out in the desert, without a drink for 16 hours. That's pretty hard.
Yeah. Well, there's always going to be this payoff. There's always going to be this balance between what we're genetically designed to do and what society is going to allow us to do. I'm quite sure that, you know, we're probably designed to have a nap in the afternoon at some point, not right, and trying to get all our hours of sleep in one batch. That's not always practical. So we have to work around this in some respects. But, I mean, what we've discussed there, I think, has been fantastic because it's given us some real concrete things that we can start to do and start to think about. And if it's inspired anybody who's watching, then obviously your book, Deadly Harvest, that's on Amazon, which, you know, it's a great book. And we had a brief conversation, didn't we, just before we started recording this about, you know, updates. It's 4 years old now, but really, it's the Bible. There's nothing else to add to it, really, because nothing's changed effectively. This is information that's thousands and thousands of years old.
Well, this is about it, really. As you may know, I do a monthly briefing as well, which answers questions and it updates. It adds little bits and pieces as the news comes through, but ultimately, the basic principles are absolutely the same. And there's nothing much I would change at all in the book, as you say. And it's bang up to date is the Bible, paleo eating, if you like, and lifestyle. I have a full chapter on all these other aspects to do with physical activity, sunshine, social connectedness, and all the various all this to do with social engineering that we also have to try and cope with.
Well, I'll get a link to that book on the information on this video, Jeff, because I think if anybody does want to find out more, that is probably the place to go. I mean, you're one of the world's leading authorities on this subject, and I know that you spend a great deal of your time and have done, you know, traveling the world, lecturing to groups of doctors and informing them of, you know, the importance of a correct diet rather than the you know, what is conventionally accepted as what we should be eating, which is very different to what we just discussed there. So, Jeff, it's been great having you join me today for this little chat, this little discussion. It's always a pleasure. And I'm sure we'll have some questions coming in from this video. And maybe we can record another one again at some point answering some of those specific ones.
Yes, of course. I'd love to, George. I'm always happy to do that.
Great. Thanks very much, then, Jeff. Bye for now.
Thank you. Goodbye.